It is easy to see situations of intractable conflict as hopeless, but it is a mistake to draw the conclusion that nothing can be done. As we've heard across this series of Conflict Zone podcasts, we find civic-minded actors on the ground in conflict situations all the time. Identifying and working with these groups can lay the basis for peace and democracy in states experiencing organised intractable violence. In this episode, we discuss how civic-minded actors can play an important role in bringing about local peace agreements, deals to end hostilities within local settings that involve the input of local communities. This can play a critical role in ending the cycle of violence and create a new space for democratic change.
A ceasefire deal has come into effect. The United Nations helped broker the agreement between the Syrian government and the rebels. This is the result of more than 2 years of sporadic and difficult negotiations.
Welcome to Conflict Zone from the LSC with me, Azaria Morgan, and my co-producer, Luke Cooper. Conflict Zone is a new series of podcasts exploring the nature of global conflict in the 21st century. We take a closer look at the causes and drivers of intractable wars. Our team of experts draw on cutting-edge research and big ideas to expose the networks of money and power driving organized violence in the modern world. This series is produced by the Conflict Research Programme, an international research project funded by the Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office.
Local agreements are a pervasive response to contemporary conflict. Because new wars are so decentralised and fragmented, we find them everywhere. And this gives new wars a local, global, rather than a strictly national, logic. But they are usually neglected because the international community focuses on the national level alone. Local peace processes can be a key strategy of conflict resolution and sustainable peace building. This should not be interpreted as rejecting the idea of national peace agreements altogether, but we do want to identify the specific role that local processes can play. They force actors to consider the authority structures that need to be built locally in order to create the basis for a lasting and democratic peace. In very fragmented conflicts, international top-down talks amongst elites may also not be able to bring about a lasting peace unless it's also backed up with a strategy to embed that change at the local level. By the end of this podcast, you'll get an understanding of this important dimension of peacemaking. We also review how these ideas have been applied in South Sudan and Syria, as well as the potential they hold in Iraq.
The United Nations suspended Syrian peace talks in Geneva after days of futile efforts to kickstart the negotiations.
Shaky agreements that in the end, like so many other peace initiatives for Syria, failed.
Part 1. The role of peace agreements in ending conflict and the importance of the local setting.
The idea of negotiating an end to conflict to achieve peace has an extremely long history, and for good reason. Bringing about an end to the worst aspects of violent conflict can sometimes create a space for alternatives to the logics we've discussed in the Conflict Zone series, the political marketplace and exclusionary identity politics. They are also an area where multilateral global organisations have a presence and can assert their influence. For a long time, the bread and butter of external interventions in peace processes has been negotiating an end to conflict and creating forums where both sides can barter out an alternative to war. But peace talks can also generate unintended consequences. If the actors taking part in the negotiation have an interest in maintaining a political marketplace condition, where violence is used to extract rents that can then be distributed to secure political support, for example, then this may be reflected in the final agreement. And if conflict is occurring on ethnic lines, then exclusionary identity politics may be legitimised by such peace processes too.
About an hour ago, I spoke with Secretary Christopher in Dayton, Ohio. He informed me that the presidents of Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia have reached a peace agreement to end the war in Bosnia.
So while peace talks remain important, they always need to be designed in a way that promotes inclusive and democratic politics, rather than consolidating political marketplace-style conditions. A key principle of redesigning peace talks is ensuring they reflect realities on the ground. For example, by taking account of the need to lift blockades, bring about ceasefires, and ensuring humanitarian access to conflict sites. Crucially, the preferences of local citizenry, not just armed groups, need to be taken into account.
A country at peace, not a killing field. A place where people can sleep in their homes, walk to work, and worship in their churches, mosques, and synagogues without fear of violence or death.
Reem Turkmani is director of the Syria Conflict Research Program at the LSE. She argues that a focus on the local level allows bringing in a wider range of interest groups, which reflects the plurality of local settings.
At the national level, things move very, very slowly, and you hardly see results, especially in contemporary conflicts when you have multiple actors on the local level and then one actor at the national level. So you have one actor on the top who has the advantage of being the one and only on one side, and then on the other side, you have multiple actors. Often they don't coordinate with each other. So it's almost guaranteed that the results will be towards those who dominate the national level.
There are different types of local agreement. It's a very broad category. So whether the local agreement genuinely brings about sustainable peace depends on the detail, the circumstances, and how actors respond. But the balance sheet in the research sites we have analysed on the Conflict Research Programme is nonetheless positive.
Especially when these talks involve ceasefires, you do see a direct impact on the number of casualties. Less people die, less people are injured, the general living conditions improve for people. Often these talks involve the delivery of local services or the opening of checkpoints for trade. So you do see a tangible improvement for people's lifestyle. For example, some of the talks can be between neighboring areas in conflict, but then they agree that I will provide you with water because the water sources are in my area, and you provide me in return with electricity because the electricity plant is in your area. So both areas will benefit. Of course, the armed actors will benefit from this, but also the civilians. You do see improvement on their lives, which often national agreements don't bring about.
But we should also be aware of the pitfalls of these agreements too.
Often these agreements are very asymmetric. So, for example, in the case of Syria, you have the regime, you know, which is strong and has a large army versus a local militia controlling a local area. So a much smaller actor, often trapped in a small geographical area. So they're very unbalanced. Often the results will be, of course, tipping towards the best interests of the regime. But when there is nothing else to do, the locals find this is the only solution, the only way to move things forward and to stop the violence and deliver services for the people, bring the goods back into the area.
They can also be very fragile.
Often these things fall apart very quickly because there are no monitors. There is no third independent actor who can act as a guarantor, who can monitor the agreement. So they may agree, for example, both to have a truce and cease hostilities, and the agreement will hold on for a few days, and then the spoilers would emerge. Often they are the people who don't want local agreement because they're benefiting from the state of violence, such as the smugglers, you know, or people who are selling arms. They want the violence to come back. So they sometimes you see them staging an attack or a break of the ceasefire so that the whole thing would fall apart. And there will be no one to monitor and say, you know, this is the party who violated the agreement. So they're a bit fragile. And when they fall apart, they fall on the heads of civilians.
Peace talks need to be multi-level, international, regional, national, and local. The current approach that tends to prevail globally, in contrast, focuses on the national level alone. Martin Achaya is a lecturer at the Department of Justice and Peace Studies at the Catholic University of South Sudan, and a consultant researcher on the Conflict Research Programme. He is critical of the traditional top-down Western approach to peace building.
For the Western liberal peace approaches, success of peace processes means good conclusion of peace conferences and publishing professionally written reports without any much concern for change of perception of conflict actors. But markers of success must include reduction in conflict, in violence, but also more equitable standard of living for citizens and recognition of mutual right, something that can only, of course, be judged in the long term.
Furthermore, an emphasis on quick fixes can lead to the neglect of efforts to build a sustainable peace.
Timeline is another key concern for international actors, making peace mediation really an event and not a process. They apply what we call quick fix exit strategies. And of course, being top down, often with insufficient understanding of local issues. This could either escalate tensions between communities or sometimes transfer local level conflict to national level. And again, the international agencies can come up with wonderful resolutions from peace processes, but hardly follow up on the implementation.
Martin Ochoa advocates, in contrast to the existing top-down approach, a civil society-based one.
Civil society-oriented approach to peace building focuses on local issues, resources, and actors. A common objective is to reduce violence and reconcile communities by addressing immediate causes of local and small-scale community conflicts. Local peace processes deal with issues that reflect day-to-day conflict dynamics and community needs and concerns, such as livelihoods, security, and economic activities. But local initiatives are also political anyway, because local conflicts are fundamentally about politics of the community, land, power, space, and access, among others. So most local peace agreements are brokered between people with shared history, interests, resources, and social connections. And they address issues that lead to trust building, confidence, and change of perception. That means, therefore, the process of local peace processes has elements of legitimacy, ownership, and sustainability.
It is important to note, however, that just because a peace agreement is struck locally does not automatically mean it has normative value. While the Conflict Research Programme has found local peace agreements to be pervasive in contemporary conflicts, the scholarship has also revealed the different forms that this can take. Some agreements entrench the power of armed actors. They may be primarily concerned with sharing the spoils of war, lead to ethnic cleansing, or simply managing the use of violence. Others, however, produce meaningful reductions in violence, improve livelihoods, and can create the space for functioning institutions, or even for working towards a larger, national-level democratic settlement. Understanding these alternative possibilities in how local agreements are struck is important if interventions are to be effective and support democratic efforts to build sustainable democratic authority. A key consideration in whether a peace will be durable is the extent to which external powers are involved in fueling violence through engaging in the patronage of armed groups and factions.
The best agreements I've seen, which really led to a more sustainable peace, were the ones where there was less external interference, particularly regional interference. So, for example, the local militias will not be funded by an external power. And then their own decisions are driven locally, often by the pressure from the civilians. So at the end of the day, the agreement comes for the best interests of the civilians. And this is very important for building sustainable peace. Sadly, in many of the agreements, you don't see this. You find externals supporting this party or that party. And the talks eventually and talks between external powers. And we've seen this, for example, in one of the big agreements in Homs, which really ended up almost like talks between Iran and Saudi Arabia. So the civilians and the Syrians were completely out of it. So less external interference is always good. At the same time, you sometimes need a neutral external presence, like, let's say, UN monitoring force or any other kind of more independent force that can monitor, that can protect the mediators, and that would also help in achieving more durable peace. Also, these agreements are always informal. They're a piece of paper or handwritten. It's not legally binding. So the more there is an involvement of a neutral guarantor, the more formality it gives to the agreement and it would be more likely to last.
Syria has been a key arena for the formation of local agreements.
In Syria, there were numerous local agreements. I mean, we mapped at least 350, and if we continue, we might even find smaller agreements that we haven't heard about. We can't say that all of them were successful. They vary dramatically between each other. Some of them, like what we call the Four Cities Agreement, ended up really like almost exchange of civilians between two areas. It's a very nasty agreement, really, that involved social engineering. But some were relatively successful in terms of reducing the number of casualties among civilians. A very important point is that we cannot judge a local agreement by its end results. Take, for example, the agreement of Al-Waer, which took 2 years to negotiate. If you look at the end results, the day of the agreement, it doesn't look very good because many civilians and armed groups eventually had to get onto those buses and be driven somewhere else in Syria that is under opposition controls. So there was forced displacement involved, and most of those people were never able to go back to their houses. But if you follow the process of the talks, right, I mean, we're talking here about a small area that was besieged. It was controlled locally by local militias and surrounded by a very strong regime. It's inevitable that the regime was going to win this because it's the strongest, it's surrounding the area from all sides. But when the local talks started, we followed the process of the talk for an entire year, counting the number of civilian casualties on each day. During that year, there were three periods where there were ongoing local talks. So there was a local negotiation committee combined of members of armed groups, local councils, civil society dignitaries, and on the other side, there was a negotiation committee from the regime. So working together to reach a ceasefire, there were three periods when there were ongoing talks and three periods when the talks fell apart, the hostilities returned. In the periods when there were talks, even though they did not reach an agreement, just they were talking to each other, there were 20 times less people dying per day and 30 times less people being injured per day. This is a dramatic, dramatic improvement, right? So it's a process. Local talks is a process. It succeeds in reducing the hostilities, often in bringing services back to the area, but the end results really varies and it often depends on which actor is the strongest.
Part 2. Taking a closer look, the possibilities for local peace building in Kirkuk, Iraq.
The city of Kirkuk is located in northern Iraq. It has historically been an entry pot of different ethnic identities and cultures. Today it is home to a Turkmen population, whose origins lie in the Turkish diaspora that chose to remain in the city after the fall of the Ottoman Empire, as well as Arab Iraqis. But overall it has a majority Kurdish population, and was occupied by Kurdish forces for several years during the war against ISIS. This ethnic plurality is, of course, overlain with the religious cleavages found in the region. Under Article 140 of the Iraqi Constitution, Kirkuk was promised a referendum on its relationship to Kurdistan, but this never occurred. In 2017, the Kurdish-controlled region in northern Iraq organised an independence referendum that led to conflict with the Iraqi authorities, ultimately leading to the loss of Kirkuk and other territories which it had gained in the war against ISIS. So in this context, and despite Kirkuk's multicultural history, there remains a strong potential for national and ethnic conflict. This BBC report was filmed as Iraqi authorities retook control of the city.
"We lost 2,000 men fighting IS," he says. "We're not afraid of the Iraqi Prime Minister."
Despite this fiery rhetoric on the streets, the Kurdish forces lost control of the city to the Iraqi government prompting large numbers of civilians to flee as they feared ethnic violence from Shia militias.
As Kirkuk slipped out of Kurdish hands, an exodus began. Desperate civilians heading north towards the autonomous Kurdish region, many eager to escape the feared Shia militias. It looked like the city was emptying before our eyes.
Many international observers are sympathetic to Kurdish demands for historical reasons. Kurdish self-determination in the Middle East has been historically denied by major global powers. But as ever, it's complicated due to the ethnic plurality of Kirkuk. This Arab Sunni resident told a French television crew he would feel like a foreigner in his own country if Kirkuk became a part of an independent Kurdistan.
They want a country for themselves. Such a thing would devalue our Iraq. I'm Iraqi and it's difficult. The country would change and in their new country, I'd be a foreigner. Who would I become then?
The demography of Kirkuk has been conditioned, however, historically by a deliberate process of Arabization, with Arabs moving into the oil-rich regions and given an important role by the Iraqi government. Dylan O'Driscoll is a research fellow with the LSE Conflict Research Programme. He explains, while the policy of Arabization preceded Saddam Hussein's Iraq, it became an important part of Ba'ath Party policy in the Saddam era.
Arabs have been moved into Kirkuk and given certain privileges and land, and this has changed the demography of Kirkuk. With the formation of the Republic of Iraq, this process of Arabization has increased, and particularly under Saddam Hussein, he really focused on Arabization of Kirkuk. So not only did he bring in more Arabs with privileges and positions in the oil industry, etc., and farmland, he also basically forced Kurds and, to a certain extent, Turkmen out of Kirkuk, again changing the demographics. And this is also paired with, I suppose, a lot of atrocities under Saddam Hussein, and of particular, I suppose, relevance for the area is the Anfal campaign, where Kurds were chemically gassed, and again, other, I suppose, atrocities along these lines have again changed the demographics. So since the establishment of Iraq, we have seen conflict emerge in Kirkuk, but mainly focusing on Arab ascendancy. However, since 2003, with the US invasion and occupation of Iraq, we have seen a slight change in these dynamics. Obviously, so the Saddam Hussein regime ended, but also because of the relative stability of the Kurdistan region in Iraq at the time, they managed to take advantage of this situation, and a lot of Kurds moved back to Kirkuk, retook land and houses, and kind of installed themselves in a better position in order to take advantage at the time. So many other communities say that there's been a Kurdification since 2003. However, Kurds would argue that they are just, you know, reinstalling the traditional demography of the city and countering the Arabization process.
So this provides the historical background for the current ethnic tensions in Kirkuk, a pendulum that has swung at different moments in the city's history between tendencies towards Arab and Kurdish dominance. A key reason the city is coveted lies in its oil reserves.
If we think about the conflict in Kirkuk, obviously oil is a key consideration. There are extremely large oil reserves in Kirkuk, but not only that, they also have the ability to export oil. So they have pipelines, you know, that lead right out of Iraq and export oil. So it has a strong importance, like a geostrategic importance, and obviously the monetary value of who controls it controls the wealth.
A national agreement exists over governance, but it has formed through horse trading amongst elites.
There has at least been a tentative agreement for the governance of Kirkuk, and this happened during the occupation, but was installed within the constitution. However, this agreement was very much at elite level, at the national level. It's not an agreement between people in Kirkuk. This happened in Baghdad and a heavy international involvement. So the agreement in the constitution had the deadline of the 2007, and this looked for the normalization of Kirkuk, so changing the demographics back, a census, in order to understand the demographics of Kirkuk at the time once it had been normalized, and then a referendum to see whether Kirkuk joins the Kurdistan region of Iraq or stays as a province outside. So this has never been implemented. Obviously, governments in Baghdad prevented it from being implemented.
Dylan O'Driscoll's assessment, however, is that implementing Article 140 of the Iraqi constitution would lead to ethnic violence.
if you implemented Article 140 of the Iraqi constitution, I think you would actually create conflict rather than mitigate conflict. So there are issues in that it largely favors Kurds and perhaps ignores the position of other communities within Kirkuk. So if we're then looking at all of these dynamics and we're looking at Kirkuk right now, a number of issues exist which revolves around political competition. So there is a competition for control, for ownership, but also rather than cooperation in the politics of Kirkuk, there is generally ethnic groups or ethno-sectarian groups trying to make sure that they progress, perhaps in place of another group. And there is this competition and it transfers into multiple levels within Kirkuk. It moves on to the security, where we have, rather than having a multi-ethnic security force that represents Kirkuk, you have multiple groups in competition with each other, and again, favoring one group over the other. And this is, I suppose, the key problem in Kirkuk, is this favoring one group over the other, because the governor in Kirkuk is an extremely important position. And rather than the governor governing for Kirkuk as a whole, generally what has happened is the governor has really focused on their own group and their own interests.
The possibility for tensions over this was seen in the 2017 conflict between the Iraqi government and Kurdish forces.
In 2017, the Kurdistan region of Iraq held a referendum for independence. During this referendum, they included Kirkuk and other disputed territories, despite it not really being part of the Kurdistan region. So they included it in the referendum for independence. And following this, the Iraqi government actually went and took back control of Kirkuk and pushed out the Kurdish forces and replaced the governor with a kind of, I suppose, a standing governor at the time, who is a Sunni Arab. And he, again, has carried on this process of focusing on his group rather than on Kirkuk as a whole. I suppose finally, when we're talking about this security and these different groups, with the rise of the Islamic State, again, we saw a slight change in that. At the time, there was the Iraqi army and the Peshmerga, which is the Kurdish forces from the Kurdistan region, were jointly controlling the outskirts. Although there was competition and not much cooperation, they were both there. With the Islamic State, the Iraqi army actually had to withdraw and they moved to concentrate on the Islamic State in other areas. As a result, the Kurds then controlled Kirkuk for the period between 2014 and 2017. And again, many of the other groups saw this as a Kurdish kind of monopoly of multiple institutions within Kirkuk. However, as I mentioned, with the referendum, this has changed again. And this is, I suppose, one of the core issues in Kirkuk, is rather than cooperation and a solid platform of governments, there is this constant change and a control for power, a battle for power, which alters different ways and has led to multiple institutions within Kirkuk that goes beyond politics. And at the elite level, the security level, conflict very much exists between the rival ethno-sectarian groups.
So whatever happens with regard to the question of territory and sovereignty in Kirkuk, building greater cohesion and support amongst different ethnic groups is key to reducing violence. Sadly, Kirkuk is not an example of a successful peace-building effort undertaken from below.
Actors such as the EU, the UN, the US, the UK have all focused on trying to reach an agreement at the elite level, and this despite there has been very little progress with elite-level negotiations in Kirkuk, and there has been a complete intransigence with regards to cooperation on multiple issues. So we've had, you know, conferences in Jordan to try and reach an agreement. We've had a range of actors from Kirkuk brought to Northern Ireland to try and look at how peace happens in this context. However, there has been very little progress. So I would argue that this focus on elites has not really led to much success, and there have been very little attempts to build everyday peace in Kirkuk.
But Dylan O'Driscoll sees potential for this strategy, as he argues that, at an everyday level at least, there is subterranean cohesion and engagement amongst the different ethnic groups, and this could lay the basis for less conflict in the future.
When I visit Kirkuk and I see at the local level, I see people are negotiating peace at this everyday level every day. So at the most part, actions of peace are happening and people are making decisions on their actions in order to ensure this. Although conflict does emerge sometimes, I think there are real positives when you look at how people interact at the local level. And this brought me to this research, which was funded under the Conflict Research Program, which is looking at how to build local everyday peace in Kirkuk and looking at how people interact. And I use the bazaar in Kirkuk as a site of interaction because this is where all the communities come and interact, and focus that actually everyday behavior. And I mean, one of the, I suppose, important parts of this study was that for the most part, at the local everyday level, people are really trying to ensure that their interactions are peaceful. And I think there are lots of elements where international actors can support this and encourage it and build these actions of everyday peace and also implement policies to try and limit the actions of everyday conflict. And through this, I think you can then help, I suppose, at a more elite level with kind of an agreement in that hopefully through the better interactions, people will put more pressure on elites to reach an agreement.
So while this idea is still embryonic, the ingredients for a civil society-based process exists, identifying the cross-community bonds that could lay the basis for a sustainable peace process, which successfully undermines the logics of exclusionary identity politics and the political marketplace.
Part 3, exploring local peace agreements in the conflict environment of South Sudan.
The South Sudanese civil war broke out in 2013 when President Kiir accused his former deputy of plotting a coup against his administration. Fighting subsequently broke out between government and opposition forces. The conflict came just 2 years after the country had won its independence.
The world's youngest nation feared to be on the brink of collapse.
When the country's president accused his ex-deputy of a failed coup.
We welcome President Kiir's invitation to open a dialogue with the anti-government forces. We hope that the violence can be contained.
The initial attempt to bring about a peace occurred in 2015. Kuyang Logo is a legal researcher on the LSE Conflict Research Programme South Sudan team and a consultant on democratic governance.
The 2015 agreement was basically a response to the conflict that erupted in South Sudan in 2013. So key stakeholders of IGAD, African Union, the United Nations, Troika countries and other stakeholders mediated a back and forth discussion with the key parties to the conflict.
The peace agreement was highly comprehensive, including financial questions, the nature of the transitional administration, and also, importantly, the question of transitional justice mechanisms. But while it was an ambitious document in some respects, it remained insufficiently comprehensive and holistic. Kuyang Logo identifies three key problems.
My criticism has been hinged on three key aspects. One is that the negotiation of the agreement, particularly Chapter 5, was top-down. It was an engagement of elites. It was an elitist process and lacked local-level consultations, a conversation with traditional authority, a conversation with the customary justice providers, a very limited understanding of local peace processes. And that was the first step where gaps were identified. And for me, that became an area of criticism and an area that needed to be eliminated as one that was not properly handled. Secondly, local level consultations during the mediation was extremely limited. A lot of the discussion of the peace process was in Addis, and there was very limited grassroots engagement. There was very limited community-level participation. There was very limited local-level stakeholder consultations. And for me, how then could the issues of transitional justice, issues of reconciliation be responded to when those at the local level have not been consulted? And thirdly, I wasn't surprised that, for instance, the text only mentions that there was need to supervise proceedings of traditional dispute resolution, reconciliation, and healing, you know? And then also to ensure that standard operating procedures were developed to ensure that the proceedings are standardized and do conform to human rights principles. And for me, I was extremely critical of this 2015 agreement, particularly the chapter on transitional justice, for those reasons.
This is a common issue with top-down peace agreements. While it is clearly necessary to attempt to bring about an end to violence between two sides, an exclusive focus on this can neglect the key need to change the circumstances that are driving conflict. This makes building new forms of democratic authority central. Despite her criticisms of the 2015 deal, Kuyang Logo argues that the Transitional Justice Agreement did establish a provision for local-level structures of peace-building. This is key to reconciliation.
You know, perpetrators live with the community. They are the top-level perpetrators, but they are also the bottom-level perpetrators, and they are there with the community. So how is the local-level structures of peacemaking, peace-building, going to complement the works of the Commission for Truth, Reconciliation and Healing? And that's extremely very important, because communities need to face one another and reconcile to be able to live together harmoniously, to be able to build on societal fabrics and cohesion. So I think they have a very, very important role to play. And what's important for all key stakeholders is to make sure that the role of the local peace processes, the local actors, are clearly articulated and their roles are linked to the broader and higher level frameworks.
Abay in South Sudan is on the border with Sudan and has long been a site of political contestation, including violence. Martin Ochaya argues that today it forms a positive example of a local peace agreement working in practice, which involved bottom-up, civil society-led efforts to bring about an end to conflict.
The peace process' main aim was to reduce violence and build relationship between the Ngok and Misiria. Conflict between the two communities has reduced now as we talk, and peaceful pastoral migration of Misiria into Abia administrative area locations has continued since the peace agreement was signed in 2016. The ingredients of the local peace process were the reopening of trade routes between Sudan and South Sudan, which has allowed for the free flow of goods. Food supplies and commodities are also transported now to other areas of South Sudan. South Sudanese travel with ease through Abyei to Khartoum and other South Sudanese towns for various needs. Relationship between the Ngok and Misiria are gradually rebuilding through daily interaction in the peace market called Amiat. The coming of the two communities to interact in that market is the best that has happened in Abyei area. The Joint Community Peace Committee, which is made up of Dinka, Ngok, and the Misiria, is the implementation mechanism that was set up, and it has its own subcommittees, which work as a nucleus for wider peaceful coexistence. And this committee continues to manage to resolve and prevent conflicts in and around the market. Not only that, but also Ngok Dinka, displaced by the Abyei Wars of 2008 and 2011, have returned to Abyei in large numbers, and there's free movement now between Abyei and other towns deep south in the south of Sudan, such as Agop. Whereas most high-level negotiations on the Abyei earlier on have taken place outside the area, the local peace agreement was negotiated and signed in Abyei.
This local grounding, with the peace market creating an everyday peace based on citizen interaction, provides an important lesson to those seeking peaceful change in other international contexts.
Part 4. A local peace agreement in Somalia. The case of Galkayo.
The city of Galkayo is divided between two federal administrative units in the state of Somalia, Galmudug and Puntland. They are both autonomous and conflict between them has erupted into violence over the last decade, since Somalia became a federalised state under the peace accord that sought to bring its decades-long conflict to an end in 2012. In this part of Somalia, the militant Islamist groups Al-Shabaab and Al-Sunnah wa-Jama'ah have also held significant amounts of rural territory. Speaking to PDRC Somalia, this businessman described how the violence had impacted daily life.
The conflict had a profound impact on us. Movement across the two sides came to a complete halt. Secondly, armed thugs took advantage of the disorder. A huge economic collapse, a mass displacement of people. Trade, education, and everything stopped.
Nasir Majid manages the Somalia Country Programme of the Conflict Research Programme. He explains how the signing of the Galkayo Peace Agreement in December 2017 was the culmination of sustained local efforts.
Puntland existed as a coherent entity for about 20 years, since 1998, but has always seen itself as part of a future united Somalia, unlike Somaliland. And in 1993, during the Civil War, two of the major leaders, political and military leaders of the time, who had contributed to the overthrowing of the state, Abdullah Yusuf and General Aidid, made an agreement known as the Mudug Peace Accord in Galkayo. And this was basically a truce rather than a reconciliation. However, it did hold until the new process of state-making that started in 2012 and that still is ongoing as the federal system today. The 1993 peace accord runs through Galkayo, through the town of Galkayo, and through the region of Mudug in central Somalia, and marks the southern border of Puntland and what is now called Galmudug region. It's a hugely significant border area, as it divides two of the major Somalia clan families, the Darod and the Hawiye. It divides the relative peace of the north of Puntland from 30 years of a much more turbulent and violent southern and central Somalia. And it also divides local Somali clans or lineages who live on either side of this Galkayo border. So it's a very multi-layered border area.
When Somalia became a federal system under the peace accord in 2012, it created Galmudug as an autonomous entity.
The establishment of the federal system from 2012 required the creation of regional states. One of these was Galmudug on the southern side of this border, which didn't exist as a state before that or as a region. The creation of this regional state threatened Puntland for a variety of reasons, a lot of which was to do with competition over this newly emerging state structure and the alliances of interests between the new Galmudug leadership and the federal government in Mogadishu, which Puntland were worried about. So this led to increasing tensions and different outbreaks of violence in 2015 and 2016 in particular, after this very long period where the Mudug Peace Accord had basically held a level of peace between sides on either side of the border. So international efforts were initially made to contain the violence, and this led to a ceasefire, but this didn't hold. A whole political economy had developed around the border area, where Al-Shabaab, the militant Islamist group, were able to take advantage of the unrest, where smuggling routes were established, and hardline elements, you might say, were benefiting from a stalemate.
After violence broke out again in 2016, attention was given to bringing about grassroots, community-based reconciliation between groups in Galkayo.
After a major outbreak of violence in late 2016, there were some new breakthroughs. First of all, a meeting of the presidents of Puntland, Galmudug, and the federal government president was convened, and a simple agreement made to resolve this still outstanding issue that had been simmering for 2 or 3 years with these sporadic outbreaks of violence. And so this was important as a symbolic statement at the elite level, but didn't imply that meaningful talks would take place on the ground. And this is where an international engagement was extremely helpful and what we are focusing on in a study that we're writing up. So Somalia doesn't have a great history of international engagement in different areas, whether you think about national peace and reconciliation conferences or whether you think about humanitarian aid in the country. International resources are captured by powerful interest groups as a matter of course, for the last 20, 30, 40 years. However, this initiative, particularly involving Interpeace and the UN Special Representative's Office, was key. And one of our points is that it was the Somali leadership, the Somali identity and the facilitation role that was played by these organisations, but particularly by some key Somali staff that worked for them, and that brought a deep level of knowledge of local peace processes within the country that Interpeace in particular had been documenting, and a sensitive engagement by international actors at the time. So Interpeace and the UN's office played a facilitatory role only, taking kind of great pains not to try to claim credit, as often does take place, or to take over the talks, but working behind the scenes to support the local joint ceasefire committee. And it was pretty much entirely a Somali effort rather than supported by international names and individuals. And Interpeace, as I just mentioned, had been involved previously in documenting Somali processes of peace building. And some of the same staff that had been involved in these documentation processes were involved in facilitating the talks and informal networks behind the scenes. So I'm not claiming either that the international side takes all or even most of the credit, but it did play a crucial role. Business people, local, political and military figures and civil society all became part of the evolving talks.
This inclusive approach to the talks was an important part of the peace effort. Rather than relying on international statesmen, the talks were also led above all by Somalis working for international organisations. This mixture allowed what we call on the conflict research programme civicness to assert itself, as civic-minded individuals played a key role. And it led to the building of community relations to become central to the peace process.
What was key is that the talks were about the rebuilding of social relations. The previous peace accord in 1993 did not have this element. It was a ceasefire, it was a truce, but people from across this physical and identity-based border were not mixing, were not intermarrying as they had done prior to the collapse of the state in the early 90s. So relations had to be rebuilt, and this required talks that were centred on Galkayo town, but also involved groups of people from these talks going to visit communities along the border to discuss the process and bring everybody on board. So part of the process of rebuilding social relations required the re-establishment of customary relations, customary law. The Somali practice of diya, or blood money, had to be re-established, inasmuch as having these customary relations provides the platform to talk, to take a dispute to local elders who can then act to quell the tensions before they get out of hand, as well as for agreeing on the terms of compensation should there be some kind of transgression, some kind of violent act. So the talks took place, the kind of agreement was developed over the course of a year or so for most of 2017, following the previous couple of years of where there'd been a ceasefire, but underlying tensions which grew into outbursts of violence at particular times. So it was a good year-long process. And an agreement was eventually signed on the 16th of December 2017 with figures from both sides, from traditional elders, from the governors of both sides, the Puntland side and the Galmudug side, the two mayors from either side, as well as by members of the business community and civil society.
The terms of the agreement accordingly prioritised rebuilding civic life, restoring social relations and community norms.
One of the points was to unconditionally remove all checkpoints and roadblocks inside the city and its surroundings. Another was to prepare a joint security force that keeps security in the region and in the town. Another was that clan militiamen present in pasture lands, it's a very pastoral area, were to remain in their respective positions until a durable solution was finally reached. And this would be monitored by the joint committee and joint forces of the Somali National Army. Another important point was to stop all violence-inciting propaganda, where local radio stations were very active in pushing identity politics, actually, from both perspectives, from both sides of the border, and that was stopped. And that the two regional governors and district commissioners should work jointly towards ensuring the security in the Mudug region.
The case contains important lessons that can be applied in other contexts.
Actually, a local agreement involved an understanding of elite-level politics. It wasn't just about local-level politics. It needed to understand what was going on at the elite level because elite-level politics were driving some of the dynamics at a local level. So that needed to be understood and addressed, as well as an intervention at the local level, in Galkayo in this case, and along the border. So the elite level agreement was necessary, but not a sufficient condition for talking at the local level. The respective capitals of Puntland and Galmudug and in Mogadishu were consulted. Key political figures had to be kept informed at particular moments. But the substantive work went on at the local level. And here, international engagement in this case was important, but it was important for its quality and for its sensitivity, when that's often not the case, with Somali figures brought in from the two organisations that I've mentioned, who had a passion and a commitment to pursuing peace, to supporting the talks in the local context. And many of which, particularly from the Interpeace side, had a deep knowledge of the context and established networks on the different sides to support and facilitate other stakeholders in these kind of prolonged talks. And the agreement, as I've mentioned, was very much based on the rebuilding of social relations. And that was important, again, as I mentioned, because it was different, therefore, in quality from this peace accord that had otherwise held for over 20 years. So the peace that now exists is much stronger than was the case previously.
So by prioritising creating strong social relations amongst the community, a more durable peace has been formed, which can lay the basis for Somali society moving away from the logics of the political marketplace and exclusionary identity politics.
Conclusion. Local peace agreements as part of a civic-based strategy for building democratic authority.
The outline we've offered in today's episode underlines how local peace agreements have to be contextualised as part of a broader strategy to build a more democratic and inclusive public authority in conflict societies. So the key test of whether a local peace agreement is likely to succeed will lie in whether it has been approached in an inclusive manner, with an emphasis on rebuilding social relations in conflict-affected societies. To be successful, these local processes will also take account of elite politics, so they are not wholly undertaken from below, but based on an understanding of how elite politics is interacting with those local conditions. Crucially, as we've emphasised across this series of podcasts, the key is to seek forms of civic-based political authority and civic-minded actors that are working for alternatives to the political marketplace and exclusionary identity politics. Identifying and helping these actors is a really important part of effective intervention. So that concludes today's podcast, and it also brings this series of Conflict Zone to a close. We hope you found them informative and educational. You can find more information on the Conflict Research Programme at the LSE website. Just put LSE Conflict Research Programme into your search engine and it will come up. You can find details on the site of upcoming events, videos of previous ones, and links to all of our publications. You can also follow us on Twitter at LSE_CCS.